Good evening. We're going to be studying in Acts, the 19th chapter, tonight. As you think about where we've been, and we've been at this class about a year and a half now, since November of 2019, we've covered a lot that's gone on in the early church. And in the last couple of three chapters, let's see. There we go. In Acts, the 17th chapter, we saw Paul on his second missionary journey. And on that second missionary journey, he had visited Thessalonica and Berea. And then we got to Athens. And after Athens, we went to Corinth. And we saw in the 18th chapter that the second missionary journey ended. And in the third began. As we look at this slide, in Acts 18:23, we saw Paul spend some time in Antioch for the very last time, and then begin that third missionary journey by traveling westward through Galatia and Phrygia, and let's see, it did turn. Doug, it's not moving on my screen. Did I do something wrong?
What do you want up there?
I want what's on the screen up there. But it's not showing here.
What did you do?
I don't know.
You broke it.
I broke it.
Let's see what we got here.
Sounds like a son needs to go to the woodshed.
Sounds like it, yep. I would say so.
For a conference.
So is that what you want?
For a conference.
Somehow you went back to, let me show you what you did. So this is the presentation.
Okay, then that's good.
So let me show you down here. So this is the presentation.
Okay.
Whereas this is the what you created.
Okay.
So what you want is, I think, this.
Okay, that's it.
Okay.
Thank you. All right, back in Corinth, second tour ends. Now let's go to slide 11. It works. Fantastic. I'm back with the game. Chapter 18 ends with these verses. Now, a Jew named Apollos, an Alexandrian by birth, an eloquent man, came to Ephesus, and he was mighty in the Scriptures. This man had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and being fervent in spirit, he was speaking and teaching accurately the things concerning Jesus, being acquainted only with the baptism of John. And he began to speak out boldly in the synagogue. But when Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they took him aside and explained to him the way of God more accurately. And when he wanted to go across to Achaia, the brethren encouraged him and wrote to the disciples to welcome him. And when he arrived, he greatly helped those who had believed through grace, for he powerfully refuted the Jews in public, demonstrated by the Scriptures that Jesus was the Christ. In our last class, we were told to keep these verses in mind as we then turn to the 19th chapter. It happened while Apollos was at Corinth, Paul passed through the upper country and came to Ephesus and found some disciples. As we look at chapter 19 begins with Apollos now being in Corinth, having left Ephesus. And Paul is making his way westward on his third missionary journey toward Ephesus. You'll remember Paul told the brethren in Ephesus in 18th chapter verse 1 that he would return if possible. And as you think about this neck of the woods, we've seen him visit a lot of places in this part of the world, haven't we? As you see Troas and Thessalonica and so on. Underlined. When we visited Corinth in Acts 18, we said that there were some factors that made Corinth so important that Paul visited Corinth more than once, 2 Corinthians 12, 14, and 13, verse 1. And we have two of the letters that Paul wrote to the Corinthians. Now we're going to Ephesus, which Paul visited on both his second and third missionary journeys, and where he lived for 3 years, according to Acts 20, verse 31. We also have a letter that Paul wrote to the Ephesians, and we know that John writes of Ephesus in Revelation, the second chapter, the first 7 verses. Because Ephesus was such an important place in the Scriptures, let's very briefly consider the influences on the city of Ephesus, on Paul, and on our brothers and sisters in Christ we've just not met yet, such as location, geography, commerce, and religion. First, as far as location goes, Ephesus had a great location, making it one of the most easily accessible cities in Asia by both land and sea. It was constructed on a river bend that was eventually dredged into a full harbor on the western coast of Asia Minor. The river had a backwash going on, and it continually had a silt problem. And that silt continued over time to push the boundary of what the Aegean Sea was touching further and further away, westward away from Ephesus. But because of the dredging and because of what they were able to do with the river, Ephesus was a very good seaport. Standing at the entrance of a valley that reached far on into the interior of Asia Minor. Ephesus was connected by highways with the chief cities of the province, east toward Colossae and Laodicea, north toward Smyrna, and northeast toward Sardis and Galatia. As far as geography goes, I couldn't find a really great picture I liked, but this shows you that Athens and Ephesus are about on the same parallel, and the little white dot under the red dot for Ephesus is the current city of Kousadasi, which is, if you visit Ephesus, it's one of the easiest way to get there probably is by ship that lands there at Kousadasi, and that's the major city in the area. Geographically, Ephesus was initially located by the Aegean Sea, the best I can tell, and had a typical Mediterranean climate, which was mild, wet winters, hot, dry summers. And through the years, again, the silting of that river gradually pushed the land mass to the west, so that now Ephesus is about 5 to 6 miles inland from the Aegean coast. As far as commerce goes, like Ephesus, it benefited as a seaport because it had one of the best seaports of the ancient world, which was able to handle the largest ships. And they had a tremendous trade in olive oil and animals and stones and pottery and so on. And all the commerce that went into Asia Minor seemed to filter a lot through Ephesus and then take those trade routes out of Ephesus into the interior of Asia Minor. And then there's religion. The city was famous for its temple of Artemis, both built and destroyed several times. I think 3 or 4 times, the best I could tell, from about 1000 B.C. forward. And the version Paul would have seen was huge and thought to have been, there are a couple of different descriptions of this. One says 378 feet by 185 feet and had 127 columns that were about 59 feet high. That would make the building that, and there's just a model that somebody drew up in your top right, that would make that building about 12 times larger than this one. And when I say that the columns were 59 feet high, when this building was built, from that wall to that wall is about 60 feet. 100 by 60 is what this building is. So that gives you some impression. Now then, there's one writer, P-L-I-N-Y, Pliny, who says that the building was 450 feet by 225 feet. The best I can tell, it was a large building. That's the bottom line there. And they worship this goddess who apparently their image impersonated the reproductive powers of men and animals and of all life. And just as was true in Corinth, Ephesus was a very pagan city with all the influences of idolatry and false worship and magicians and readily available access to immorality. The imperial cult of emperor worship was present in Ephesus, whereby the Roman emperor was worshipped as a divine being. The temple of Domitian and the temple of Hadrian are examples of the cult worship of emperors. In summary, Ephesus, one writer wrote, was the jewel of Asia. It was the capital city of that Roman province of Asia during the 1st and 2nd century and the center of trade in that part of the world, with a harbor that could accommodate large ships, and stood on the main trade routes from Rome to the west on to, toward the east. It had tourists coming in from all over to visit the temple of the Greek goddess, and it was considered, that temple, one of the seven wonders of the world at one point. It was famous, it was magnificent, it was wealthy, and it was lost in sin. And if you have a moment, after class, look at Ephesians, the second chapter, the first three verses. They were dead, and Paul wrote, "Dead in you were dead in your trespasses and sins." Verse 3, "You formerly lived in the lust of our flesh." And verse 12 goes with it very well as also. Today, Ephesus is one of the largest Roman archaeological sites in the eastern Mediterranean. During the last 10 years, it's estimated that 1.5 million people a year visit the ruins there. And you just can't grasp everything in a short visit. As we study Acts 17, 18, and 19, I thought it was interesting to see that the Apostle Paul visited three major cities of the ancient world, and they have some remarkable similarities. Each had a key location with seaport, and Corinth had two, and they had desirable geographical features. They served as major commercial centers. Each had a temple to a false goddess, and only Corinth had an athletic game that also contributed to the circumstances. But all these factors contributed to a large population of Jews and Gentiles that could hear the gospel. When you look at this slide, things have changed since the days when Paul lived and Ephesus was the center of travel and commerce with that great seaport. The port of Ephesus was filled with silt over the years, and it's, as I said a moment ago, about 6 miles inland from the coast. And as the silt filled in the water route to the coast, the area around Ephesus and the ancient harbor turned into a swampy area. Malaria epidemics affected the population, killed many people, and over time, Ephesus lost its prominence. So from this aerial view, from the where the harbor is marked on the right-hand side and ancient Ephesus excavations are in the red circle, to where the Aegean Sea is on the left, you can see a good bit of distance. It now has to be covered to reach Ephesus from the Aegean. But one writer says that they think when Ephesus was established, it was right near the Aegean coast. At the archaeological site, there is a sign that, let me go on. There's the Caistor River first, that helped the people in later times get to that harbor. At the archaeological site, there is a sign that shows very clearly that they believe a harbor was there. Now then, on this next slide, though, that's what it looks like today. It's just filled in. There's no harbor there anymore. Interestingly, and I'd hate to know what this is going to cost, the Turkish officials say that they're going to reconnect the Aegean Sea and that ancient harbor by constructing 20,000 and some feet of canal so that the tourists can come in from the Aegean to see the ancient city. Be nice to see if you could access it that way. From Kusadasi, it's about a 45-minute to an hour drive by motor coach now. This is out of a book, but it gives you an aerial view of just how small the excavation area is from the era on the right leading across through to the left. The first excavation of this area was done in 1869, and it's still estimated that only 15 to 20% of Ephesus has been excavated today. And today it is protected by a UN agency that works to guarantee the stability of the area and protects it from looting. The main street in Ephesus is the Curetz Street, and we'll go down that street in a moment, and there's a stadium off to the left that we'll see a picture of. And then there on the left of the screen, you see a white strip, and that's the street that would have led down to the harbor and the street up which Paul would have walked if he landed at the harbor and was coming into the city. You know, when we were in Athens looking at pictures of the day, what, 2 weeks or three ago, at the Areopagus up on the top left side, there was a plaque which presented Paul's sermon. And then in Corinth, there was a plaque at the Bema, which was the judgment stand, identifying Paul's appearance before Gallio. In Ephesus, there is a plaque that says, when the Apostle Paul preached between A.D. 52 and 55 at Ephesus, he was confronted not only by an active pagan cult, but also by a lively Jewish community as a result of a rebellion led by the silversmith Demetrius. Paul left the city in order to resume his missionary activities in Corinth. In other words, I just find it interesting that in three different places, there's acknowledgement that Paul was there and conducted activity in those locations. As you look at a closer map of the area, you see the harbor in blue and the canal leading down to the river that will lead on out to the ocean. You see the Curetz Street there marked in the right-hand side, and the Acadian Way, which is also called the Harbor Street. The Harbor Street was about 1,700 feet long, leading down to the harbor, 0.3 mile. The temple to the Greek goddess, called Diana by the Romans, by the way, she was called Artemis by the Greeks, I said a few moments ago, was listed as one of the seven wonders of the world. The picture at the right is a model that the archaeologists think the temple may have looked like. It was destroyed more than once. The measurements differ. We mentioned them a moment ago that it was a very large building, many times the size of this one. With the passage of time today, there is nothing left of that temple. They have taken some of the remains and have stacked them up, and in the little yellow circle is a man standing by that column, but that column is only about 45 or so feet tall. And you remember the archaeologists are telling us that these columns on the temple were closer to 60 feet tall. So it kind of gives you an impression when a man stands there of how tall those columns could have been at that big day and time. This is the main street that you can walk down in Ephesus today, Curetz. And this view is from the upper eastern side, and it's one of the oldest streets in Ephesus. And one of the reasons you might want to walk from this side of the city to the other, to the western side, is that the elevation changes and slopes down. A sign there says that this street is 689 feet long. It's 22 to 30 feet wide. It had a sewer channel running under it. There were shops on either side where tradesmen and artists and innkeepers offered their services. As you enter the area, there's a marble relief of Nike. There's pieces of ruins on either side of you as you enter the area. And at the bottom right, you have the remains of one of the larger baths that was heated even at that point in time. In this picture, as you enter the site from the upper end, you walk through the agora where the shops would have stood. On the hillside there on the right-hand side of the picture is the odium, which would have seated 1,450 to 1,500 people and was used for meetings and maybe for some small concerts. The Senate for the city would have met there as well. On the left, you've got the Memmius monument that was in honor to the grandson of a Roman dictator. And as you might expect, there on the right, you see what's just remains of the Temple of Domitian. At the bottom right, that's what the Curetz Street looks like. You're walking on marble stones right down the middle of the street that have been there a mighty long time. As you continue down the street, I guess I would hope to see complete buildings. It's not going to happen. There have been too many earthquakes and too much time that's passed. And at the top left of this slide, you see where the city government was conducted. At the bottom left is a commercial area, what's left of it at least, where the craftsmen, including the silversmiths like Demetrius, could have had their shops. And you've got the Temple of Hadrian there on the right. In this picture, you see some beautiful tile work on the side of the Curetz Street at times, and you see a portion of some of the other structures that were located there as well. At the bottom right, you've got the Trajan Fountain, which initially was thought to be one of the major structures in Ephesus, one of the more beautiful ones. Now, there's an enlarged view of that pavement to show you how ornate it was. I'd love to have seen the original. Interestingly, just like today, there are people that have more and there are people that have less. And they have found six residences of the wealthy, and they have begun to excavate them. They were set up more like modern condominiums, located on some terraces at the lower end of Curetz Street, on the side of the mountain there. And while the tour of Ephesus costs you about $13 and a quarter, you have to pay another $6 to go in to see these residences. As you saw that building there, what they've excavated is under a roof, because they're not done digging around under this roof and seeing what they can find. So that's why you see a structure over this. Two of the houses have been excavated, placed under that protective roof, and it's believed these residences of the rich were used on from the first century on into maybe the seventh century. The houses consisted of two or more floors, had fantastic mosaics, beautiful tile floors, frescoed walls, ornate columns, marble construction, interior courtyards, their own clean running water system, private baths and toilets, a heating system with clay pipes under the floors, and hot air was carried behind the walls. Sadly, nothing remains of the upper floors today. Now you can see the floor there in the middle, So I enlarged the picture so you could see how ornate that is. Just, they did some very, very beautiful work in some of these structures. That just simply gives you a view of how massive this area is on the inside. They do have designated walkways. Some of them are aluminum covered, where you certainly don't walk on the areas. You can visit part of this with elevated walkways, and you see those frescoed paintings on the walls and so on. Here's a slide that shows you pottery that they found. You can see on the walls there in your bottom left how they painted the walls and decorated the walls. On the right-hand picture, you can see how ornate that doorway is. The right-hand slide, again, you can see the ornate picture on the floor and the walls. A short distance, maybe as far as less than the distance from here to the road out front, there is a structure called the Library of Celsus that was built in about 110 A.D. to honor a man's father. It was damaged by earthquake, and they set it back up in more recent years and is visited by a lot of people today. But it's basically only the facade. You know, it doesn't go back and have any depth at this point. You've gone down Curette Street, you've gotten to the Library of Celsus at the end of the street, and you turn right. And when you turn right, you're going toward the stadium. Now I'm going to have to change slides. Okay, now then, a little bit closer to home. We're all familiar with this stadium, aren't we? It'll seat about 22,000 people. Many of us have been in that stadium, right? Here's the stadium, the grand theater, if you will. That's so impressive when you see it, and it would seat about 25,000. You know, we're big stuff in Bowling Green with 22,000 seating, you know, spread out. This one seats 25,000. And to begin to show, you see people here in the picture with the stadium in the background. I say stadium, it's the theater. The stadium was on off to the north of this just a little. Now then, you can start seeing the people in the seating areas. And there you go, and the higher up you go, the people get smaller naturally. It's a very impressive structure. It was first constructed in the 3rd century B.C., enlarged during the Roman period. It was the largest theater in Asia Minor, used not only for concerts and plays, but also for religious, political, and philosophical discussions and gladiator and animal fights. In modern times, just as a note, Elton John and Ray Charles and Sting and Diana Ross and others have held concerts here. When you're in that stadium, theater, and you look straight ahead, you're looking down Harbor Street toward where the harbor would have been. That street is about 3/10 of a mile long. They believe there would have been shops on either side as you go down that street. As you come up from the harbor, they would have had several opportunities to try to entice you to buy merchandise or buy mementos of your visit, I guess you would say. And that gives you a little bit of view there on the right of what the view would have been like from the up on in the higher levels of the stadium. So you can see that Harbor Street stretches on down to where the harbor would have been. when Paul boarded a ship from Ephesus or landed at Ephesus, he would have been going down that street or coming up that street. And just for what it's worth, this is what the archaeologists suggest that area would have looked like, with the Temple of Artemis up there in the to the top of the slide, the stadium off to the left, the grand theater that we just looked at, and then the path down to the harbor that would have had shops and buildings on either side of it. I guess my takeaway from these slides is that, you know, I've read about Ephesus, but it was these slides at least tell me that it was a very real place, and Paul spent a lot of time there. We have brothers and sisters in Christ we just haven't met yet that lived there and were converted there from a pagan world. Hope you found those interesting. Any questions or comments to this point? Sherry.
Today, is it Muslim, or is it Greek Orthodox Jew, or is it, what's there today, the religion?
Nothing is in the ancient city.
Not in the ancient, but in the area.
I can't tell you. I would be speculating with you.
Because Paul would have had such a hard time teaching. I mean, that would have been really.
Well, we know that this Ephesus is in the country we know as Turkey today. And I don't remember all of the news because I don't pay attention to all the news, but there's a lot of unrest in that area of the country between different religious groups. Anything else?
Did you and Linda visit that area?
Yes. The slides you've seen of Athens and Corinth and of Ephesus, I took all these pictures, or most of them. There are a few that, you know, I can't get a good aerial view or so on, but I took most of the pictures that you've seen in these classes with Athens and Corinth and Ephesus. We were very fortunate on that trip to see those places. And we're scheduled last year to go back to all of these places plus some. And now we're scheduled to go late this year. But I'm not holding my breath. Anyone else? All right, let me see if I can get back to the beginning of where I want to be. All right, we found the beginning. In the 2 minutes that we have left, in Acts, the 19th chapter, the first three verses we read, it happened that while Apollos was at Corinth, Paul passed through the upper country and came to Ephesus and found some disciples. He said then to them, "Did you receive the Holy Spirit when you believed?" And they said to him, "No. We have not even heard whether there is a Holy Spirit." And he said, "Into what then were you baptized?" And they said, "Into John's baptism." You'll remember that in Acts, the 18th chapter, the 19th through 21st verses, I said earlier that Paul had told these people that he would return if God allows it. And verse 1 shows us that when Paul arrives in Ephesus, he does find some disciples there. And verse 7 says that I think there were 12 men who have learned some things about Christ, but who have not been fully taught. As we look at this, the word disciples in this verse comes from a Greek word, which I'm not going to pronounce, but indicates a learner. Perhaps they had been disciples of Apollos. are perhaps disciples of John the Baptist. Luke simply does not tell us exactly. However, Paul wants to know more about them. In verses 2 and 3, Paul begins to ask questions of these disciples, like Philip's question in speaking to the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts 8. That is, to learn, I think, the spiritual condition of those to whom he's speaking. The answers they are about to give, though, indicate they've not learned what they need to know. And with the clock saying what it does, I would ask that you read the 19th chapter, and we'll look at this again on Wednesday night next week.